And he entered Jerusalem and went into the temple. And when he had looked around at everything, as it was already late, he went out to Bethany with the 12. It's an interesting ending to the Palm Sunday story that Mark tells us. Some of you may remember last year when we read the Palm Sunday story from Matthew, when we all took part in sort of a reenactment, because Matthew tells the story a little bit differently than Mark does. In fact, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all each have an interesting take to this Palm Sunday story. And as I was thinking about that this week, I wanted to just dig in a little bit more to both the similarities of these stories, but also the differences. Now, to be sure, most of what happens in these stories is similar. For instance, in each case, Jesus and his disciples have been coming for a while to Jerusalem. This is the culmination of Jesus' ministry. And when you read the texts, it really builds up to this moment. You know that there's going to be a great climax. Jerusalem is such an important city for Israel. I mean, certainly religiously, that's where the temple was. People would make pilgrimages for these high holy days. And so Jesus, too, along with his disciples, and it's not his first pilgrimage to Jerusalem. They've come each year, according to our records in the Gospels. But we know that this is where a lot of the Jewish people and others are gathered. It was also Jerusalem and also an important political place for Israel. It is where David sat on the throne during in a time that was greatly honored and remembered in the time of Jesus by the Jews of his time. The throne of David was what ushered in this sort of political stability and wealth for Israel in sort of its greatest but short-lived time of some political power. It was still a small power compared to the other big powers around it, but it was at its height during that time. And so then Jerusalem is the place that the Messiah is predicted to come and to sit on this throne of David. And so we know from all of our Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that Jesus and his disciples come to Jerusalem. We also know that he rides a donkey, this not just a donkey, the colt of a donkey. In fact, Mark tells us that this colt has never been ridden before, which is an interesting point in this story, because, first of all, donkeys and horses don't really like loud noises. They don't really like surprises. And a colt that has never been ridden before is going to be hard to ride through the streets with people shouting and waving funny things in the air. And yet Jesus is able to ride this colt, to have the strength and the gentleness to calm it and to help it feel secure enough amidst chaos around it. But he doesn't even own the colt. I mean, the colt is not his. He has to borrow it. It's not even a gift from somebody. He doesn't keep it. He has to return it afterwards. So he comes on this rather sort of risky kind of animal, this very humble animal, as opposed to the Roman soldiers who are riding in on war horses to protect this city, to protect it at this time when all of these foreigners are going to be coming in for this big celebration, and Rome wants to make sure nothing's out of hand. So they're on their big war horses that are well trained and that will show their power. And Jesus is on a very different kind of animal riding in the other side of the city. So the donkey, this borrowed, unbroken colt, is a prominent part in all of the stories. And in fact, not only that, we also know how the people reacted, many people, when they saw Jesus. They gathered. It was joyful, and they threw cloaks or leafy branches, palms of some sort, onto the path that they made for him, just as we saw the children doing, just as that joyfully happens every year in churches all over the world in memory of that. And they shouted, "Hosanna," which, as has been pointed out, means save us. In fact, it's a really immediate understanding of that. It's even more like save us now. Now is the time. We're ready. Save us. And so they were very hopeful, and they had these ideas of what that might look like. Maybe this was the Messiah. Maybe this was the moment. Maybe salvation really is at hand for us living under a foreign occupation in an unjust way as a small and beleaguered group of people. All of the Gospels set this scene. They're actually remarkably the same as they lead us through this parade. It is only after the parade happens that they differ. So in Matthew, like I said, last year, we have Jesus going presumably right from this triumphal entry, right into the temple where he overturns tables and confronts the powers that be for being corrupt and using that as a place of commerce instead of a place of worship. What we have come to know as the cleansing of the temple. And this is the most movie kind of version of it, right? He's got this procession, and they all follow him directly in, and there is this large confrontation. Now that's one Matthew's version. And in Luke, first of all, Jesus stops, and he looks over Jerusalem, and he expresses this deep sadness that he has. And he cries over Jerusalem. Actually, first the Pharisees confront him. They say, "These people are being too loud." In Luke, they say, "Shut up. Make them shut up, Jesus." And he says, "This is such a joyful occasion that if these people weren't quiet, even the stones would cry out." And so there is, first of all, this great swell of positive, joyful emotion. And then Jesus steps away and he weeps over the city, saying how he longs to gather its people in. And then he goes into the temple and cleanses the temple. And in John, this is the passage that Pastor Richard spoke about last week. When Jesus comes in, it attracts the attention of many other people, and these Greeks say, "We want to meet with Jesus." And it is in that discussion following that Jesus declares, "My time has come." But in Mark, he goes to the temple quietly. He looks around, and he goes to spend the night with his friends in Bethany. And then he comes back the next day, if we would keep reading, and he goes into the temple, and this cleansing of the temple is described in much the same way as the other Gospels. Now, thinking about these differences, I don't really think that they present for us a problem in understanding the story. After all, Matthew and Luke do not say this happened that same day specifically. We sort of assume that the way it's written, but there could have been a night in between. Now, what actually struck me about the differences wasn't really the timetable. It was the difference in emotions that were presented by Jesus. And if you sort of combine all of these stories together, what you see is this very, very full range of emotions that Jesus expresses, from joy along with the crowds, and even in knowing that this is the moment, this is the time, to deep sorrow and even anger at the injustice that Jesus sees in the temple. There is this wide and complex range of emotions that Jesus feels. And it's not the first time we see Jesus being emotional. In fact, as his death becomes more imminent, I think this sense of heightened emotions grows within him. But throughout his ministry, we see him joyfully inviting the children. We see him stopping to heal someone out of compassion for them. We see him weeping at the death of a friend. Jesus engages with people. He feels with people. He does this as much as he engages in theological treatises or intellectually correct ways of thinking. He looks around. And I would argue that this time in the temple of looking around is not the first time Jesus looks around. Jesus often stops and notices what's going on around him, who the people are, who needs healing, who needs to listen to him, that the people are hungry and need food. Jesus looks around and notices what's going on. Jesus engages with that in emotion, and this Palm Sunday story and this plethora of tellings of it set together emphasize that. But meanwhile, there are other forces whose primary interest in this is not the same as Jesus. It is not to be aware of who the people are and what they need at this time and what their plea means. No. Their job is to keep order, to make sure that things don't change too much. They have made plans. They have set goals. They have constructed the world in a particular way, and Jesus, frankly, is offering to transform their thinking and their world, and it is not comfortable for them. They need to protect their religious institutions, their political systems. They need to be sure that nothing is too dramatic that it will upset the way things are. And so they will go to great lengths, even to killing Jesus, rather than letting him disrupt their institutions and their plans, and their paradigms of how the world works. They have an idea of who God is and what their religious institution, what their, quote, church should look like, and what it is supposed to be. And when that is challenged, it's pretty scary. And so perhaps they are looking inwardly at their institutions and their plans and their paradigms more than they are looking around them, more than they are noticing the people in the streets and the people in the temple. It's interesting for us to look at our church, our religious institution, and to ask the question, what is our church? Who are we? Are we a group of people who are intellectually in sync and on the right path and with a really good theology? Are we people who joyfully gather each week to worship God and then to go out into the world and to share our faith with others? Are we an irrelevant institution that is dying and doesn't much make a difference in the world in 20th century Lombard, Illinois, the U.S., the world? Are we a group of peace activists who gather here to be empowered to go out and to make a better world? What's the right answer? The right answer is, this isn't our church. This isn't our church any more than the temple belonged to the Pharisees or the governing bodies that held it. This isn't our church any more than Jesus belonged to his first disciples. This isn't our church any more than the death and the resurrection of Jesus belonged to those who witnessed it personally. This is God's church. This is God's church. And so we can look at this church and try to make it fit our plans and our paradigms and our ideas about who Jesus is and should be and what we think the Messiah is and what saving us will look like. But when we do that, we kind of step in front of the parade and block the view for others. We kind of get in the way of the possibility of being truly transformed by what Jesus will do. Left to God's devices, the paradigm of Messiah looked different than anyone in that crowd that day imagined, be it the religious authorities or the children waving branches. Almost certainly no one there knew what the next week would hold for Jesus. Almost no one there could anticipate what salvation, not just for one group of people or one political ideology would mean, but salvation for the world that came through not a typical king sitting on a throne, but through a suffering servant. Almost everyone was surprised by the way God acted, and yet the way God acted created something more beautiful, more transformational, more enduring, and more widespread than anyone there could have imagined. And that, my friends, is the story, I believe, of Palm Sunday. It grew out of Jesus' response to the people around him. It grew out of God's knowledge of what the world truly needed. And so, as we think about who we as a church can be in the world today, I invite us to remember that this is not ours to hold tightly to. That our ideas and our plans and our programs and our paradigms may not be the full story. But what God has in mind for God's church is more beautiful, more abundant, and more world-transforming than anything we can imagine. So as we enter this week, this Holy Week, we too are invited to join the fantastic, awe-inspiring events of Jesus. We too are invited to enter with a range of emotions. But perhaps most importantly, we too are invited to stop, to engage in holy pauses. Like Jesus, let us stop after times of chaos and emotion and look around. Look around at what God is doing, and maybe we will see things that ignite our righteous anger that God can use in the world. Maybe we will see the glow and loveliness of those around us, and we will celebrate and rejoice with them, and maybe we will weep. Weep over the brokenness, weep over the sadness, weep over the struggles with one another and all those around us. God makes all of those available to us, and in all of those, God, and through all of those, God can continue God's work in the world. And so let us also this week take a sacred pause. Let us, before we rush on to the next thing, to the temple cleansing, to the Good Friday, to the Easter even, let us pause and look around us. Let us be a church that is less interested in becoming who we want to be and more interested in becoming who God wants us to be. Let us become a church that is looking around at the work that God is doing in the world and seeking to join that work. And let us be a church open to what among us must die within us so that it can be resurrected, transformed, and that we too can be surprised by the work of the beautiful artist God who will add new color, new texture, and new imagining to